you have any questions about your question?
I knew I'd figure that.
Any questions on what we talked about the other day? Further cogitation, reflection on it. Okay, we looked at looking at what science is, the theory of science, the logic of science, and we're still defining our terms. We've defined science in the narrow sense and in the broader sense. In the broader sense, it is explanation gained by sensory interaction with the world. In the narrow sense, it is what?
Method.
The methodology, the way of gaining information. And it is a limited way. One of the dumbest things about the age of scientism is that it is generally assumed that the only real, quote, end quote, way of gaining real knowledge is through science. That science is the fountainhead of all knowledge that is real, which is very, very narrow. A great deal of information, of knowledge that we have, is gained by all kinds of ways that are not scientific.
Wouldn't a lot of people know that, like Carl Sagan, and why the area of science, and they would say that it didn't have things to say on all these things,
yes,
and we narrow it down.
Well,
if you're going to have a discussion with one of these kind of people, you're going to have to get all this straight, aren't you?
Yes.
That's what you're talking about.
Now it would be like, he does like that. He's in the theology, and they're always in the question of origin. Carl Sagan represents the popular science, the popular mind of scientism. Here you go, the opening of this cosmos theory. He's the main statement, for instance, that you go back to the ultimate, to the beginning. He says that that if we do not accept the idea of God, then we must accept the idea of eternal matter. And the idea of eternal matter is no more and no less unbelievable than the idea of the eternal God, and since the idea of eternal matter is no more or no less unbelievable than the idea of the eternal God, there is no need to go back beyond matter to God. So he doesn't. Okay. You'll debate if you had eternal God or eternal plot. He opts for the eternal plot. Matter. Well, that shows he's not a very good thinker. Well, he's again.
You're right.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, that thinking that you just stated right there, that he would consider part of science.
Yes, that's right. He's considered part of science. He would consider that scientific thinking. It isn't even good thinking. Mm-hmm. Remember, I said propositional proof must be homogeneous? Mm-hmm. He's comparing apples and oranges. What would you say about that statement? He said that the idea of eternal matter is no more or less provable or unprovable or believable or unbelievable than the idea of eternal God. Why should it be necessary to go back? Here's what he worried about, I recall. We don't need to go back. There is no need to go beyond matter. So we can start with matter. But he said, he would say, okay, you tell me, you say to me, I'm Carl Sagan now, Mr. Gossett, you point out that I cannot say where matter comes from, you tell me where God came from. Mm-hmm.
Entropy kind of the word too, doesn't it?
Ah, so it puts it in danger. principle of second law of dimension. Well, there's two fundamental errors in thinking of this. You mentioned you should be. You're not getting this. One is this word, there's a built-in fallacy in this, and they're kind of used it all the time. You see it in popular humanism. It's the word need. You don't need to go back. You see, you often hear at university, especially undergraduate courses, you'll hear Christians refer to those who need a crutch. Why? You see, it's very common to believe, or say anyway, that believers, like people like us, are people who believe in God because of a psychological need. We don't want to be alone in the universe. We don't want to be. We're not content with that, but existential epistemology. We need the idea of a personal God. Well, that's a fallacy. That's the psychogenetic fallacy, as you said, is logic. The psychogenetic fallacy says because even if we're true, if that you've identified why somebody thinks something, you have therefore disproved it. Well, I would point out, first of all, that when you said, why do we need to go back, that assumes something that's not true. That puts a twist on the debate. That is not a true twist. We do not go beyond eternal matter back to eternal God because of a need. As a matter of fact, even if we did, if you say this John Bell believes in God because he has a need, that does not prove that God does not exist. This is exactly the argument of Robert Owen. You know, I can understand what Robert Owen can't even do. It's systematic. He thought he'd identified why people believe he had, but he thought he identified why people believe in God, therefore God does not exist. And then so the common fallacy, the genetic fallacy is that you judge an idea true or false on the basis of the source. That's genesis. The phylogenetic fallacy is the fallacy of denying X on the basis that you show why John will believe in X. This is why you believe in this, therefore it's false. Because if I believe, if Daryl Combs, if Daryl Combs believed in God for all the wrong reasons, every reason he had believed in God was opinion and irrational, it would not be the content of not exist. So it's just going to be a content of belief. So you understand? So to suggest, here's what he suggested, this is the twist that's on that. The only reason anybody would go back beyond eternal matter, the eternal God, is some kind of psychological need. Now, understand, need has nothing to do with it. And if you want to act, but if you want to pursue that point, it is not the human inclination. It is not the universal human inclination to lean toward God. It is the human inclination to lean the other way. That is, if man has a universal need, psychological need, it's the need to get away from God. Not man is not going hunting for God. God goes hunting for man.
But when you answer to this, a man's always been religious folks.
And we never knew about it. That if we escape, I would cite as circumstantial evidence that it's the universal worship of self. That is, if man has such a great psychological need, how come atheism and secularism has dominated our public institutions? Do you understand that man doesn't run toward God because of some kind of need? Man runs the other way. It's all belief, it's all and he runs toward God. They tell me a man needs to not believe, especially a sinner. And you'll see this, by the way, when we look at this course. We look at you still would study evolution. You see overwhelming amount of evidence. I maintain, actual debate. If a man doesn't believe in God, he's going to be irrational. Well, I just mean, otherwise, I should do not believe in God. At least I'll say God's dead. I don't want to. Whatever I have this need to, you know what I'm saying? You want to appreciate anyway, it doesn't exist anymore than at least. In other words, there's left there for every person who believes in God because he doesn't. What I'm saying, for every person who believes in God because of a psychological need, you find 10 people who don't believe in him for the very same reason. So I'm not saying 1 to 10, either. You can get my point. I'm not really specific. Now, however, let's go along with that argument. So I reject that word need. You said there's no need to go back beyond eternal matter to eternal God. But the fundamental flaw in this thinking is that the idea, the concept of matter, and the concept of God are not homogeneous. They are not equal. That's his fundamental fallacy, the basic fallacy. The other one's secondary. Why? Because there is built into the idea of matter certain qualities, characteristics, and this is where Scott's comment comes to the fore. That is, from what we know about matter, we find it very, that if we believe that matter is eternal, then we have to believe that matter, in some place, at some time, acts in a completely different way than we've always observed it to act. See, if matter is eternally degraded, if matter is eternal, and matter degrades at the known rate, then there is nothing here including us. Because if matter has been degrading at the known rate for eternity past, it is already degraded and we ain't here. Otherwise, so I'm not caricaturing anybody's position. They'll say, well, there must have been a time when there was some other physics operating. And we'll get this when we get into the theories. Somebody suggested I have a paper on the theories of the origin of the universe. We'll get into that. So that is the clock wound up, and then the usual analogy. You understand that? So, but there is built into the concept of God the idea of eternality. So eternal God versus eternal matter. Well, if matter is eternal, then there has to have been a time and place, at least one, the matter acted in a way which doesn't observe that. But, so eternality is not built into the concept of matter. Eternality is built into the concept of God.
Well, if matter is ever, if it ever acted originally, then the amount that would mean it could be natural, right? If it's not natural, it could be natural.
Well, no, it would be supernatural. It would be abnormal.
Well, then, isn't that a fair objection to God? God is.
Well, no, you can have abnormality in the natural realm, theoretically at least, without getting into supernatural.
Okay. It would be another natural way.
Yes, it would be another natural way to put it. That is, and when you would have, because matter now is intrinsically degenerative, you would have to have a time when matter was intrinsically generative. Because we are here. You see, whether you believe it or not, you got to have Genesis. You got to have Genesis one way, at some place, because we're here. I think we are. Okay, as an aside, but we're commenting on his observation. It's a good observation. Now, here's an example. He goes beyond science. You see, that is, it's like, let me illustrate it this way. I've done this in another connection. At one time, matter was generative. It went from low degrees of organization to high degrees of organization. The clock got wound up, as it were. Some kind of genesis. Because everything we observe now is degeneration. Second law of thermodynamics. What I'm saying is that at this point, we cross over from science to theology or philosophy. Because theology, really. And Carl Sagan does by his statement, he stands here and make the comment in this area that doesn't admit that it's not scientific, that he's getting out of his area. Okay. Now, continuing our discussion on the process, or the process to be scientific. We talk about scientific proof, and I have it in the thing here, a prospective scientific proof. Science has proved it. Well, that's a favorite. That today is a religious statement for all practical purposes.
Science has proved that, and fill in the blank.
Now, what do you mean by scientific proof? Well, before we can say this, we must examine, give it a context, a perspective of the categories of proof. Science, I point out here at the bottom of the first page, is only one category of proof. This is by observation, experimentation, and all the other aspects of the scientific method. But just to give it a perspective, I list on the top the other categories of proof. There is proof based on authority. Do you believe in heaven? Yes, I do. Upon what kind of evidence do you base your faith?
The answer is authority. Why? Because Jesus has established his authority, and his authority we believe is the second coming.
Now, his authority is another question. From what you get the question on what is he based his authority, then we go back to the resurrection. Understand?
But his authority is the resurrection, the basis of that we accept as true his statement that he is coming back to the
dead. That's what the Bible says. If we believe that God raised him from the dead, then we believe he's coming back. It's a biblical proposition. There is proof based on logic. A logical proof is a kind of proof. It's limited based upon its assumptions. The validity of his proposition. If it is true that all men are mortal, and if it is true that Socrates is a man, then it is true deductively that Socrates is mortal. Aristotle. Now, but logical truth is that if, then kind of truth. And ultimately, by the way, all logic, I live here, deductive and inductive, but really, with human knowledge, but still I'm going to get into this because it's not the place to do it. Ultimately, all logic is deductive. If things are inductive and secondary things, because you arrive at your inductive logic, not human deductive. All induction is expanded deduction. So you draw all deductions from your deductive completely.
Please illustrate these three categories of proof: scientific, authoritative, and logical.
And if there's something we know is not, scientific proof, there's proof by authority, and proof by logic.
Let me illustrate it this way. One morning in the Garden of Eden, before the fall, Eve, being all woman, noticed a strange smirk on Adam's face. You know about this in the Bible, but this is a pseudepigraphy. Copy from which you were excavated as well. This is now being translated. Anyway, Eve noticed this smirk on Adam's face, and so she wonders if he's got something going on the side. He's seeing another woman. So she, being in her pristine perfection, she decides to resist the night's fallacy. I'm going to approach this scientifically, authoritatively, and logically. If she decides she wants to approach it scientifically, then what kind of proof would she get that Adam was being unfaithful to Adam and a woman? Observe it, catch him a neck, behind the tree of life, he's around in the hair, he is playing flat and pickle with another woman. So, therefore, she has scientific proof. Why? She has a But suppose she decides that's really going too far. She doesn't want scientific truth. She wants authoritative truth. How would you get that?
You'd ask God.
Or ask Adam. You'd ask Adam. Now, it's not as good as scientific truth. You'd ask Adam. Now, would Adam is kissing another woman, you would say yes or no. But would that be, upon what basis would that be, quote, proved, end quote?
On his trustworthiness.
Yeah, on his trustworthiness. On Adam's credibility. Trustworthiness. Because Adam, this is before the fall, you see. Because Adam, sin has not entered, therefore Adam tells the truth. Therefore, when he says, no, I've not seen another woman since he can't never sin yet, then she can accept that he's credible. Authority is proof. But catch him in the act, she asked him. So he has logical proof. Yeah. What did she do? Yeah. Jesus said, I'm going to approach this to be done in logic. He's the only one who's not creating. No other one in there. What she does is, she really believes the word is waiting to come in and say, happy birthday. Right?
Okay.
Logical proof. Now, is that we should be sure. He's missing one verse and he got me. If he's missing two, then if a missing rib means another woman, A, B, if he is missing in, take proposition A, if Adam is, if the absence of a rib proves the presence of another woman, and B, Adam is missing a rib, then C, there's at least one around, there's another woman around somewhere, whether he's found it or not. Plus, what you need is limited. See, that's limited by a number of things. But then that just beats up his logic. Now, you can't go that too far, but that'll help you remember the three categories of proof: scientific, authoritative, and logical. But there are different kinds of proof.
What was this muffin now?
No, I was working about it. No, he's just happy. I don't know. Now, do y'all see that? So, we don't. And if you ask a question that demands, if you ask a scientific question, then you don't get historical, you don't have any other kind of proof. You have to be homogeneous. Now, for instance, someone says, show me God and I'll believe in him. What you say? Show me God and I'll believe in him. What's the assumption behind that?
God
is able to do human nature. You see, the fallacy in that is that whether there is a God or not, if there is a God, such as the Bible describes, he is, as the Bible says, not available to human senses. No man has seen God at any time he was there. By his very nature, he is not a human man. Therefore, by that test, you are making it impossible for yourself to believe in your God. That is, by requiring that if you show me God, I see God, I believe in you. What you're saying is, if there's a certain kind of God, then no one is impossible to ever come to faith. If the true God is beyond that test, that kind of test, then my rules of investigation will make it impossible to ever believe in you. That's why the person, now, I'm not just being cute with it. A person who says, demand scientific proof of Christian faith. Very often ask a question and one of them kind of answer. You see,
can you prove that God created heaven and the earth with nothing scientifically? No, not by the very nature of it, but the nature of the act rules it out. All you can show is probability, circumstantial evidence. So the person who asked that question is ruling out the end, he's ruling out the possibility of everything. If he set up a situation that I will believe only under certain conditions, and those conditions automatically rule out reality, then your system, your method, will keep you from reality. That's very true, but very much true in science.
For instance, I just finished a book that I'm going to bring to class and talk about these kinds of the author of the Steady State Theory, Fred Hoyle. And Fred Hoyle says, very interesting comment in the book, he says, now that he's not a Christian, nor very likely I shall ever be a Christian, because I have not found clear evidence of God. This is a common statement to you, but I've not seen proof of God, therefore I don't believe. You see it very often. I've not seen it. You look at the university, I've not seen proof of God. And when they say these can be scientific proof, I have not seen any scientific proof of God, therefore. And all they don't think this is proof, they don't really know what they're saying, because they just have a lot of proof. You see, by setting up that rule, until I find scientific proof of God, by that they mean absolutely objective, completely objective proof of God, which they mean is, I set up, in other words, what they're saying is, I set up in my mind a kind of world that would exist if God existed. That kind of world does not exist, therefore God does not exist. Well, what that does, it assumes, first of all, it almost has to be God to have that much knowledge. In other words, the person would almost have to be God, logically, to say, to construct in their mind the only possible world is there is a God. And the illogical, just the best of all, it is, they also say things like this, but if there is a God, this is the best he can do, I don't want him anyway. There's the world of present conditions, and say, well, Jay Gould used that argument against creationism. He knows evolution, he's admitted evolution, at least as this understood is absurd. But if God was going to create, why are there so many strange forms, awkward forms in the natural order? Surely, intelligent God would do a better job of it. Well, that's the argument he used. He talked about the panda bears opposing the thumb and the Scottish elk and overburdens and antlers and things like this. Well, see what he's doing is he's saying, in effect, or in fact, that I know if there were a God, I know exactly what the world would look like. Since the world doesn't look like that, there can't be a God. You understand? Well, very presumptuous. That is, the world may look like it does for all kinds of reasons. We will not fall without sin, without built-in adaptability. You know, the presence of a mongoloid child, a Down syndrome child, is not proof that God does not exist. The presence of AIDS is just proof that it's proof he's around. See what I'm saying? There are all kinds of possible explanations. So what they're really doing is, what I'm trying to teach you is a person who approaches it that way, I'm talking about these categories of proof, I'm not off the subject, I'm on the subject. What they're really doing is setting up, you can, by mixing your categories of proof, or by constructing your questions such a way, that you can rule out the truth. If there were about it, you know, if I construct a test in my mind, whatever it is, as this is commonly done now, if I construct a test in my mind, say, I have 13 or at least 50 or 500 point criteria, which if there were a God, these would be met. Since the criteria are not met, there cannot be a God. What I'm really doing is I'm ruling, if the criteria are false, this is the very much where it will be, I'm making it impossible for myself to come to believe in the truth. But if there is a God, and his presence indicates an alternate explanation to some of these criteria, or they're loopholes, some of them, or adding others. See, my list, my criteria, has made it impossible for me to believe. It's like a man saying, it's like a man, really, in every company, women all can do this, because women, I'm trying to illustrate my point here, and then we'll talk about Mary and I. Women are very sensitive. Women communicate with each other at a level that seems spooky to men. You know, a woman has got a real close friend, a girl and a girlfriend, and there's something bothering them. Their best friend knows it immediately. The boyfriend may find out a week after next. It's too late. And often with a girl, a young woman, especially the younger they are, the more they do it. They're going to be mad at their, about something. When they get mad at their roommate knows it instantly. But she'll be mad at the boyfriend. He doesn't know that she's mad. And so she'll play this game. If you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. What she'll say is, it's not my best friend picks up on it because she cares about me. So she in effect says to her boyfriend, but without saying it, she thinks toward him. Now, I said what she did. If you really love me, you'll pick up on it. I'm just going to see it. Am I right? It's exactly what they'll do. I'm going to see if he figures it out. Good luck. And so he's in trouble and doesn't know it. You're married, tells her they're in trouble, didn't know it? Yeah, I've been telling her for 2 weeks before I found out. One time I was dead for a week. And so, she's just on the stage. And what she's doing, she's treating her husband as she did with another woman, you know. But what she's doing is, I've got this barrier. He doesn't want to stay there. I want to see if he did it. Well, she said it. If he wouldn't touch me, he'll figure it out. If he doesn't figure it out, there's evidence that's wrong. It's fair enough. So what happened? He failed the test because you didn't even know you're thinking. It's hard enough to pass the test that you know you're thinking. But I promise you, cannot take the test. You don't know you're thinking. You're going to flunk it. But what she has done is, because of her misunderstanding about men, that men have to be told twice, sometimes more than twice, before they see men, which we demand language, words. and then we don't get it. Because what she does, she makes a fundamental error of assuming that her boyfriend or her husband's mind operates the way hers does. She sets up a rule, a test of his love. And because the test is faulty, she may think she has discovered that he doesn't love her. As a matter of fact, he loves her very much. It's just that he is not in a position to pass us through the test. So, you think I'm making this up? This really happened. Well, you see my point? So by her, because her test is faulty, she may come to the conclusion that he doesn't love her, and his love is real, very true. It just cannot be proved by that particular criteria. You can't tune into her subliminal suggestions, the man in his throat. His mystery signal. Well, you see, and we do this in life all the time. For instance, we'll set up a test and we'll say, now, you know, some of our categories of truth, how we think about things. And we have to keep our proposition and our proof in the same class. Not what I'm trying to teach you. It's broad application. That is, often we will say, people ruin creatures this way. Often you have some people in the church, they get me a creature. They will set up categories in their mind and say, if he's a real creature, they'll do these four things. The one I'm going to tell him. He's lucky enough to happen to be calling the last people, preaching the last subject, not preaching the last subject, and act a certain way toward him, and then he passes the test. But if he doesn't,
body, not spiritual. We judge one another like this, don't we? We say, what we do, we can set up a test, even at the psychological level. I mean, that level, we set up a test to rule out the truth. Understand? Because of a faulty question, faulty set of criteria. That makes sense to you? Well, now I maintain, I think I can demonstrate it, that atheism that fails to believe in God is a clear example of this, a mixing proposition of truth. Okay. Any questions on that before we move on? Well, next in our definition, we're going to define the Christian worldview of nature. Somebody read Psalm 83 through 9. I don't have my other question, but you can sure that. Psalm 83 through 9.
Psalm 83
through 9.
When I consider thy heaven, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? Yet thou hast made him a little lower than God, and hast crowned him with glory and majesty. Thou dost make him to rule over the works of thy hand. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and all the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the sea.
Okay, look, as you see the nature of the universe, the nature of man. When I look at the heavens, I see you. I look at man. What is man, this created creature that you should even notice? The greatness of God, the attitude of man. Now, that's the Christian worldview of nature. That is, that the natural order, not just the biological or living order, the natural order is a product of the creation of it. It came from nothing. It was created by God. And that man is a special creation by God, in the image of God. That's why man, God notices man in the way he does not notice the cocker spaniels and the baby, despite what John Denver says. And I don't trust a man who smokes pot, goes and talks to flowers.
They talk about it.
That's the problem. They have much to learn. Anyway. That's the Christian worldview. Implications, we're going to talk about the implications of the Christian worldview of nature. Number one, nature exists for spiritual purposes. That is, the natural order is not just here by accident. It's here for spiritual purposes and is capable of a teleological explanation. Somebody tell me what teleological means. Are you familiar with the professor? No, let me tell you. Teleological. What's the word teleos in Greek?
In.
Complete. Finish. What is the teleological argument for God? Argument from one word. The word I prefer is more often the word purpose. And it is design implies purpose. It's created for something, isn't it?
Yes, that's a fundamental question.
Look at what is here. All the way from the farthest star, the farthest star system, to the smallest virus and amoeba on Earth. Is it just here? Just here? Or is it here for something? It is capable of a teleological explanation. Now you see, that's the fundamental question. Is it here for, does it complete a plan? Or is it part of a plan? Is it part of a design? Teleology. Now, you take this question apart, you would ask it at a reduced level. Do you see evidence of design in the natural order? We certainly do. One of the real problems, give you an example. was a real problem that the evolutionists had. We're going to see later on that the idea of gradualism, neo-Darwinian gradualism, that tiny mutations operated on by natural selection over vast periods of uniform time produced minute changes which accumulated into larger changes which accumulated into species. Thus we have the origin of species, neo-Darwinism. One of the real problems with that is that gradualism, we're going to see later, works with mathematics, but doesn't work with biology. Why? Because when you look at the complexity, the interdependence, the specialization, the particularization of biological order, for example, only biological order, you see design, you see teleology, you see organisms and organs, which are clearly doing something they were designed to do. The eye seems to have been designed for seeing. The eye does not appear to be an organ that popped into existence and fortunately is able to see by some mere chance. It seems to have been designed for a purpose. So you see teleology within teleology. Biological teleology implies cosmic teleology. And I like to read these guys, non-theists, but they're trying to explain because they cannot. I did my professional time at the university. I said, have you observed, Dr. Jensen, that the authors that you have in your reading, in the introduction to their books, they dismiss the idea of design? But then they use the language of design in the book. They introduce it to the back door. They dismiss God as a myth and use nature as a metaphor. And what the myth could not do, the metaphor does, is design its plan. And I said, you notice it's impossible to even talk about the reason to do that, but it's impossible to talk about the natural order without the language of design. He said, you don't agree. It's impossible. What they hear in one class, they don't qualify, they'll say. Well, let's stop now. This is not their word, this is what they're supposed to have. Let's stop now and remind ourselves that all the design that we've been talking about is only apparent. It is not really design, it only appears to be design. Okay, there's a claim.
Mother Nature.
Yeah. Well, but they didn't claim that now, most modern books. For instance, give you an example. You take a foot. Now the foot, by the way, the foot is a very complex instrument. Don't ever put down the foot. Do more than kick footballs and get bunions. The bone structure is highly intricate. You balance on it. It's amazing. The foot is an engineering marvel. But see, the foot didn't start out being flat. Why? We started out with nothing. The foot started out, let's put it on how far back I'm going to go, being, to use a generic term, an appendage.
I like that. Appendage.
On something.
Greek appendix.
For some reason. Now, we've got, we're talking about teleology. Now, between the appendage and the foot is what?
That's the question you asked.
Did the appendage get to be a foot? Did the appendage get to be a foot overnight? That is, this creature was some barely post-Cambrian, sea slug or and semi-amphibian or whatever. Went to sleep one night with an appendage quivering. Phil called back. We'll grant the flipper. when the door opened. Therefore, somewhere along the line, you had to have an appendage that belonged that was just a, that was well on the way to being a foot. There's no idea whatever it came off on. So it didn't have to be. That is, you know, they call this anesthetic evolution. That is, what happens is that different appendages by chance perform other functions, and fortunately, there's some mutation. There's got to be something to work on. But you see, it got there by accident. There could be no design. Therefore, when this appendage was, say, 3/4 of the way to being in the foot, you cannot admit that there's anything behind it that you're designing to be in the foot. So there isn't a foot. There isn't a foot for either. There isn't a hand. What is it? You get what I'm saying? That is, well, if there's no, there's nothing there, and if at this stage,
here's what I'm trying to teach you,
if at this stage of development, there is no plan on walking, there's nothing saying, this thing isn't working for walking, I think I'll do something better. I'm going to walk, I'm going to have to change this footwork. Because when you get a run, there's nothing around planning, but although, here's my point, although there's nothing around planning on having a foot, you have to have a lot of, before you get a foot, you have to have a lot of antecedent evolution of organisms, of organs that are on their way to being a foot, but aren't a foot, and nobody ever planned on it being a foot. It just somehow got to be a foot. And when they got the foot, it looked like somebody planned the foot, but they didn't. I mean, you really got to have rocks in your head.
Are we planning on keeping your foot, or is it going to be
the whale, you know, went the other way. The whale went back to the water, you know, that's why it goes this way, instead of this way. Let's take our break. Popped into my mind, and I went to the library again, and went to the catalog.
And did you get thought from an appendage to wait until your brain is?
Come back to it.
This book, I have to tell you, I'm a teen girl. And I, what's that? I knew we had it, but we didn't see how we
had it on the other. Pre-adaptation
is the word. Talk about teleology. You see, how do we get to different forms? Adaptation. Macbeth, Norman Macbeth calls the word adaptation the magic wand that the evolutionists wave over all biological forms to explain everything. How? Then you got the little. You got a cactus that grows an appendage that does not need for a bird, a particular kind of bird. Who figured that out? Adaptation. About that's true. I like what he's got. Well, that's adaptation. Well, what about the stages in between the appendage and the foot where you have no purpose? You have to have pre-adaptation. You understand? You can't be adaptation because the flipper is useless. Anyway, this is on human evolution, my area of professional study. And let me read, this is Ashley Brace, Celoid Brace and Ashley Montague are two of the godfathers of human evolution. I mean, you know, we like him. Listen to this, evolution being opportunistic as well as cumulative. This is called personification. Evolution being opportunistic as well as cumulative frequently takes advantage of structures developed under certain circumstances and uses them as the base for adaptation to change environmental circumstances. Mm-hmm. Very flexible. Such a condition is referred to as pre-adaptation. Pre-adaptation. The reaction. application of the reapplication of structures, listening, the reapplication of structures originally developed for other purposes has accounted for some of the otherwise remarkable developments in evolution. Although, here's the disclaimer, although this should not be taken to indicate that there was any such preordained plan. You ever talk about genealogy? Now, for instance, the eye, Ernst Mayr says, the eye, obviously, sort of in a pre-adaptive state, was an organ that was going to do something else, all of a sudden, evolution being opportunistic, will say, hey, I haven't thought about it before, but you can see with this booger if you just give away the house. Just the hair, and well, I wasn't going to do it before, but hey, what up, see? Well, if they can talk about being about nature, evolution as being opportunistic, I can talk that way too. you had to have pre-edit, and on the way to being something, if there's no design, obviously, you have to have a process whereby it appears to be by design. Tell me. On the way from this to this, there appears to have been the foot appears to have been designed for walking. Does it not? The eye appears to have been designed for seeing. Let me read that again. Now this is I use it at university. It's very good at things now, but it's standard work. Which, if you don't believe it, you just follow the term chart. And this is simple nonsense, by the way. You should recognize that as such. Evolution, being opportunistic, is such a condition is referred to as pre-adaptation. Reading it, pre-adaptation is the reapplication of structures originally developed. Oh, sounds very teleological, doesn't it? Originally developed for other purposes. Now, wait a minute. Has accounted for some of the otherwise remarkable developments in evolution, although this should not be taken to indicate there was any such preordained plan. But if there's no preordained plan, how can it have been originally designed for anything? You see, my point is they cannot, even in their nonsense, they cannot talk about the natural order without the language of teleology. And so what you get God asked to leave because he may live, and then you get a metaphor of evolution doing all kinds of things. Get that? Originally developed for other purposes. Now that is a nonsense statement. If there is no teleology. Although this should not be taken as indicating there was any such preordained plan. But then, you see my little... Then he goes on. The four fins of the early Paleozoic fishes were a pre-adapt four fins, having four of them, The four fins of the early Paleozoic fishes were a pre-adaptation for a later life on land. The four fins became legs and feet. The four fins of the early Paleozoic fishes were a pre-adaptation for later life on land. Although, it should be stressed, you gotta not read this stuff. I know why you don't. All go ahead. Violin music in the same. Although it should be stressed that their initial appearance was simply to enable the fish to function more efficiently in the water. Not by design, doesn't it? It was simply, listen to this, it was simply a matter of chance that it was later possible to modify fins. Modify? It was simply a matter of chance that it was later possible to modify fins into the legs of the earliest land tetrapods that had four of the walk on. Listen, these guys are like us. You know that. Hey, you got that? Another logical nonsense, alone biological nonsense. I mean, it should be dismissed as logical nonsense before you even get to asking whether it makes biological sense. If I sound like I'm being ridiculed on this, that's one of the things exactly what I'm doing. This is ridiculous. I got examined in this, by the way. I want you to know that I'm a certified expert in this. You know, it's really tough keeping a straight face sometimes. Another example of pre-adaptation. I'm serious. Another example, see, a lot of people think they've got an education. A lot of people think they've got an education because they know a whole lot of why they sell. Another example of pre-adaptation is exemplified by the whales and dolphins we have previously mentioned. When their land-dwelling ancestor was made over, by whom, I ask? By evolution, I am told. Evolution does not exist, an abstract concept. It's a metaphor. Oh, never mind, let's go on. When their land-dwelling... I think you got the reason. When their land-dwelling ancestor was made over for an efficient aquatic method of locomotion, whatever made it over, did it efficiently. The up and down capabilities of the spinal column were utilized, that means used, and adapted by whom, I asked again. As the mechanism for moving and propelling flukes of the developing tail. In this case, the type of movement, you understand that, you know, a shark swims like this and a whale, a dolphin swims like this. The type of movement had, listen to this, originally been developed. The language of teleology has written and developed for effective terrestrial locomotion, and then was remade, as it were. Well, that makes more writing because it's as it were. You gotta think about this. Remade, as it were, is pre-adaptation because this up and down method, which is developed for effective terrestrial locomotion, which it is, on and up and down is coming. Anyway, we'll grant that. As such, was remade, as it were, for aquatic propulsion. Why, we're still a great nation. As such, the direction of the spinal column movement can be regarded as a pre-adaptation for its element. As such, the direction of the spinal column can movement this way can be regarded as a pre-adaptation for its subsequent use upon the re-entry into the oceanic environment, back to the water. Again, we stress that there was no preconceived purpose involved. That last thing, while I go to the Smithsonian Institute, is a classic. We stress there was no preconceived purpose involved. Notice how nicely the whale swims, how efficient that is. But it's almost as if the former mechanism was remade. Redesigned for a very efficient aquatic locomotion. Isn't it? Nice how it worked out. What he's saying is, it was overwhelmingly clear that it was doing what it is designed to do. I cannot talk about it without the language of teleology. It's so amazingly efficient. Pre-adaptation makes no sense apart from teleology. But we must stress that there is no teleology. And I say, why not? And his answer would be because. It's a very, you see the point, it's a, and that is, could be. That is so irrational, it is creepy. And by the way, many, many, many have revealed that. This is one of the reasons why the cutting edge of the restoration, Goldschmidt, he's out of the way now, and Hoyle and Gould and Niles Eldridge, we're going to be talking about them later, are simply saying, let's cut out that nonsense. Now, this is what the textbooks are doing. Let's cut out that nonsense and simply say that somehow there emerged a whole new form. Let's just admit that how did the cold blooded reptile get to be a warm blooded bird gradually? Let's just admit that a reptile is a past the bird. Obviously, it's a fossil record, that's what happened. Let's just say it happened. Let's just cut the nonsense. Let's say that this creature is. Mated, and their baby had a foot. You know how to use it. Four of them, as a matter of fact. Unfortunately, also around the corner was another couple that also had a baby that had feet. Their baby with feet had a pretty baby to marry, to mate with. You get the point, in other words, all you do is accumulate the absurdities. But what I'm trying to say to you here is that one of the reasons evolution is now. The theory of evolution as a metaphor, as a discipline, is an absolute chaos. It is absolute chaos because many of the godfathers have had all they can take of this kind of nonsense and said, let's cut that out. I mean, regardless of what our conclusions are going to be, this is nonsense. It is nonsense, yes.
I remember in my 10th grade biology class, my biology teacher was telling us that. Certain animals that came into being and adapted from a two-legged animal into a three-legged animal because it could run faster and survive better. And then it slowly adapted into a four-legged animal. Well, she treated me as a little, and I just didn't
know.
Yeah.
Because
never used the term evolution, but she was always saying adaptation. And I've always come to the belief that, you know, animals can adapt to their surroundings.
Oh, within certain.
Within certain.
Very limited. Yes. But you see, one of the assumptions of that kind of adaptation thinking is based on is this, one of the unspoken laws of evolution. I call it law of evolution. Law of quotation marks. But one of them is a need is a cause. Why did the animal have four legs or three? Well, needed four. But you see a need in the biological of the cause. That's the kind of thing in popular kind of language. But the experts don't have a problem. A need is not a cause. Why? Change is not coming about at all. The adaptation, the whole concept of adaptation, assumes that change is coming about by need. That is true of evolution. We'll talk about microevolution and macroevolution later on. So I won't get into that. But adaptation is this magic wand, as McGrath says it is. And pre-adaptation is more of a magic wand. So you understand? Pre-adaptation is a whole bit of nonsense which he just lays beside the way on him. But this excellent is an attempt to see if it can get qualified. There is no purpose, there is no design, no teleology.
Why did it have four fingers to begin with? Would it have been more efficient
chance
to have six or eight
in the more proximity of your body? Or whatever. Yes, you see, chance. You can read stuff like that. I even point out to my professor after we got to know each other very well. That was nonsense. He agreed with what was Well, he said, their approach is, well, you know, these theories, we don't. He said, you must understand how scientific theory works. They are useful. We use theory, so they, this is a, you want to know how they operate. They say, we use this kind of thinking, not because we think it's true, but because it's useful to lead us on to progress, scientific progress. But that's not what they're telling the kids in school. Tell the kids in school it's a fact.
in the textbook. But they get, you know, but the, well, actually, really, we don't, we know that this has problems, but you see, we use theories not as settled truths, but as methods and guidelines to further progress. And then we cast them aside. But in the meanwhile, we cast them aside and go on to other concepts. So pre-adaptation, it'll help us for a while we're, you know, getting our ducks in a row, and then we'll move on to something else. And they have, it's called punctuated equilibrium. We'll get to that later. But in the meanwhile, here's what they're doing. They're saying, yes, we realize that this won't hold up logically or biologically. It's just a tool that we're using. What a hypothesis is. It's a tool that we're using in our ever upward spiral of progress, scientific progress. But in the meanwhile, we'll put the textbooks as facts and tell the kids that if you don't believe it, you're stupid. Well, that's exactly what's going on. You got that? Well, that's really duplicity. As I've said a number of times, one of the things that struck me first in the university was the vast gap between what I call textbook evolution and the theory as it's held by the godfather, I call it. Vast gap. You know, it doesn't know that you all took high school science, high school biology, or you took an undergraduate school. In some cases, graduate school. I tell my kids, I tell my own son, hey, you ought to know that the experts, the big boys, they get together and laugh at this stuff that you're being taught. Very condescending, like this evolution of the horse from another. G. Getter Simpson, they come out. It's not, we know it never happened in nature, it's a dawning of the textbook writers. It's in the upcoming edition of my son's biology text. The evolution of the horse from Eohippus, the modern horse, Equus. It's in the latest edition. The paleontologists have known for 60 years that that's nonsense. They've been saying it for 40 years. That's a fiction. Fossil evidence.
Why don't you go after that?
Well, it's been done. Macbeth is back in the 70s, pointed out. And then,
well, why does the school work for you? You pointed out to that.
I just had a go around with the man. In fact, he's the guy gave me the textbook because I pointed out this is really anti education. And they said, well, you know, it's the best of God. And they tried to get me off their back. I thought, hell, I'm off the hook. If I'd have forced a review of the textbook, it'd be very expensive, but it would have cost them. See, their problem is, and they admitted it, the guy who's in charge of the textbook selection for the whole area, the whole school system, their problem is, and I acknowledge this, their problem is, they say when you have teeth in this stuff, you document it, but it's my son's textbook, this happened about this year. How it came out was, yes, Dr. Chambers, we know you documented this, but they questioned it. This is a bad time. But we don't have anything else. All the textbooks have this. Here's the new one. It's either this or no textbook.
Now, why can't there be a struggle?
And they say, well, they have no textbook. We're going to take the textbook as it is, because they all have this. They're all the same. Then they're right. They're all the same.
Why can't the teachers be instructed then?
You can never visit in public school.
Take religion and take.
I've done it.
This is not true. Don't teach us for a fun book. And teacher, I'll show you. Here it is. It's not true. So you just skip over it.
They can't teach it. Can and they do that. But often, I found that the high school teachers, because in their education, they have to study some of that educational method and to learn about their topic. And many high school teachers can't pass basic tests in their own field. And the fact that one reason they're trying to crack down on teachers, you know, only know how to teach what method, but don't know what to teach. And because educators have been running the education system, it's all confusion. And so now the emphasis is upon not on what you teach, but how you teach it. They infinitely multiply courses in how to teach.
In my experience, I've been in the high school 2 or 3 times. In my experience, that in every case, I have had to teach the teachers the theory of evolution. They didn't understand that. They didn't understand the theory itself. And they couldn't. Not only did not understand the creationist viewpoint or any criticism of it, they didn't understand the system. I mean, normally to be unkind, that's true. Now, I'm sure that hasn't been my experience in other cases. But my son's high school teacher blasted creationism in his hearing, so I wrote an object of a formal complaint. And documented it. And cross-crushed it. But you can't. I pushed it as far as, if I'd have pushed it any farther, I would simply have been causing trouble for no, I made my point. I've been causing trouble for no reason, whatever, it would have been counterproductive. But when you get the head man admitting truth is a defect in the soul of God, that really bothers me. But there was stuff in the textbook that was like a horse. I can show you. The scholars say that. So you get a sense of the Godfather of the Godfathers. He said about this, the darling of the textbook writers. But of course, quote, it never happened in nature. It appears only to happen in the textbook. It's not this whole orthogenic evolution straight line, this nice neat. It's one of the primary proofs that, you know, looks so clear. Oh, you have to look at that nice orthogenic, monophyletic progression. It creates a vision. And I'm going to show the same thing with the anthropology charts, which are a hoax. Not from a creationist point of view, but from an anthropologist point of view. Absolute hope.
But you see how people are placed?
But it creates a visual image. It's very convincing to people.
So the speech of the horse is one of the things you're talking about, the evolution of the horse?
Well, that's simply a nice, neat line. For instance, this simply does not represent any fossil evidence. For instance, the earliest one was the Hypocotherium, which wasn't originally classified as a horse at all. The Eohippus. Anyway, it's kind of complicated. But my point is, there's a great deal of dishonesty going on. Well, I got me off on this bit, but that, let me get back to my main point. Talk about teleology. But this kind of stuff, which is standard, I call textbook evolution. I don't just mean in high school, I mean in undergraduate school, even some graduate school. It's what I call textbook evolution, which is enforced by our courts now. It's the only theory of origin that can be taught. That it is full of this nonsense, and this is one of the errors of teleology. And that, here's my point, and that, my point of divergence this morning, that it is not simply creationists who are pointing out the absurdities of this way of doing business, intellectual business, and they have been creationists pointing out for decades. It is the evolutionists themselves who are crying out for a new concept. Neo-Darwinism is dead, except for the textbooks. They themselves, I'm going to show you evidence of it, are crying out for a new concept, because this is simply superstitious nonsense. And that's a really word. What you're looking at is superstition. That is naturalistic superstition. And yet, the fact that you saw this kind of level, remember I said the other day, you laughed. You thought, man, I don't know how serious you took it when I said if NASA practiced this level of science, that they would never got it off rocket past Diplo. You see what I'm saying? That is simply irrational. It has not only biological, you understand, not simply when you examine the biological forms, but when you examine the inner logic of it. You accept their assumptions, it is still irrational. The intra-logic fails. Okay. Nature exists for spiritual purposes and is capable of a teleological explanation. It does. We are not, and of course this gets into anthropology as well. We are not just here. We are here for something. And at the micro level, you have teleology. At the biological level, you have teleology. You clearly have teleology to the extent that nobody can talk about the natural order without the language of teleology. Hence the disclaimer is thrown in, it's only apparent, it's not really a purpose, no really a design. We very clearly have a design, but we have no design really. That it simply implies that what my point being that teleology at the biological level implies a teleological universe. The very existence of it implies teleology. Second, so we're talking about implications of the Christian worldview of nature. Second, the universe is maintained by the providence of God. Paul wrote to the Corinthians about the idols. There are many lords, talking about these false gods, but there is one God by whom, this is 1 Corinthians, what is it, 12? Or 1 Corinthians 8, the discussion on idols. First Corinthians 8:6. For us, as opposed to the high pagans, there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. Paul says in Colossians, in him all things consist, so that the universe is maintained by the providence of God. I indicate the impossibility of pantheism. What is pantheism? This is the New Age thing. This is where we're heading now. We're moving away from secular humanism to cosmic humanism to pantheism. I've got a book. The latest book by Fred Hoyle is Pantheism. It's called The Intelligent Universe. There's no intelligent God, but the universe itself is intelligent. This is Hinduism.
Somehow a living being.
Yeah. Somehow it's a monistic concept that somehow all nature is of the same order, all things, man, plants, animals, in a stone, and that everything, the only difference is in degree. There are no generic differences, only differences in degree. All levels of man is the highest level of consciousness, but if you go down to the rock, who's just there, rock, you kind of have some level of consciousness. You step on a bedbug, it has some level of destroyed consciousness of some kind. And that there is a quasi-divine spirit interpenetrating all is one. Now, the force, evil and good are one. Different sides of the same reality. This is Star Wars. Star Wars is pantheism, New Age thinking. The song that I mentioned before, right? We are the world. You know, the ethic is not love your neighbor, but be your neighbor. By saving the children, we save ourselves. It's a pure nonsense, pantheistic nonsense. If there's no I, thou relationship, as Martin Buber says, everything is I. I am a part of the great I. The world is one mother's self. Anyway, this is pantheism. It's coming. If you go to a New Age bookstore, holistic health is a part of it in some aspects. And I remember my sermon, I talked about the idea of man is God, can do anything. What the mind can believe, the man can achieve. That kind of nonsense. And the extremes in this, you have university professors now see the extremes that if we really hit the mind in the right groove, we can practice levitation, out of the body travel, overcome the physical world. Why? Because it's all a part of one reality, and we can move from one level of reality to another if we just get in on it. Christian science, it's pantheism. That is, but you see, my statement in the syllabus is the impossibility of pantheism. Why? Because, again, it's simple nonsense. We are not God. There is in the universe, as Paul says to the Corinthians, many kinds of bodies. We're not all one. There are different kinds, there are different aspects of reality. There is not simply, and there are separate realities, not simply one reality. That all the universe is not simply different levels of emanations from the divine, from the impersonal divine. The universe is not divine, and we are not God. Pantheism is simply pantheism. The growing pantheism, New Age thinking is called. Maybe we've
taught this at the Professional Dean Chambers University.
Sure does.
Good. This is an overlap. That this is evidence of the extremes to which man will go. Fred Hoyle's book, I'm going to talk about the origin of the universe. It's clear evidence of the extremes that man will go to avoid the obvious. That is God. It's amazing. It's one guy said, pantheism is clear evidence of it seems to be popping into my mind that I haven't written down in the past year. Sit. This is working.
We call the source. The statement is this. Class, can I write this down? Class, they're talking about the impossibility of pantheism. The statement is this, and I'll get the source for you later. The man who stops believing in God, does not start believing in nothing. The man who stops believing in God does not start believing in nothing. Got that? He starts believing in anything.
That's great. That's what the whole court of the church is paying for. That whole thing is what the whole thing is. Anything else, that's it.
The man who stops believing in God does not start believing in nothing. He starts believing in anything.
All right, you got it. What do you think about that? That's
fine.
You're not good. That's classic pantheism. A man, and this is clear, the New Age movement, this rise in pantheism is clear evidence of that, of the truth of that statement. The man who stops believing in God doesn't start believing in nothing. He's like believing in anything.
Under this theory, everything you come under someone who is truly pantheistic at the same time. If you're a creationist, if you believe in the Bible, hey, it's all about one thing. You believe that, I'm going to do whatever you want.
Well, that's not really it. That's not what the point he's getting at. Is that with the. Here's what he's saying.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
But that's not really the focus. What you say is true. It's not the focus of this statement. It's this. Biblical theism is overwhelmingly the only rational explanation, the only rational worldview. Therefore, when one overthrows biblical theism or something corresponds to biblical theism, he has to become so irrational that he will start believing in the irrational. And the degree to which he accepts it is increased by its irrationality. He starts believing in anything. Anybody who can understand pre-adaptation is a concept that is so irrational that from a biological point of view, no matter what point of view, whether creationist or evolutionist or whatever, and as I say, many leaders are saying it's irrational opinion, it is so irrational that the question is, who would believe that? Who would put stuff down in the book like that? I'd be humiliated to put anything like that in the book and put my name on it and stuff. Anybody would read it. I mean, you know, it's just like admitting you got herpes. Who would, it's humiliating to be an irrational. So, what he's saying is that this is human nature. Romans 1, God is the reprobate mind of Romans 1. That when you stop, when you refuse to have God's knowledge, you end up in pantheism or something like that. The man who stops believing in God because of the very nature, the rationality of that, doesn't start believing in that, he starts believing in that. I made the statement long ago, before I went to university and studied evolution, that show me an evolutionist, and I've got a bridge on myself that's in Brooklyn. I mean, anybody would believe in that, wouldn't anybody? I'm serious. It is so irrational that it really takes a, well, I lost all my professor. And he didn't understand what I was saying. I mean, he didn't. I said, we were pretty good friends where I laid this on. And I said, I'm Western evolutionist now than I was when I started studying under you. And I said, the reason is I'm not religious enough to be an evolutionist. He knew what I meant. Takes more hit. I'm just not that religious. I don't have that much faith. I simply have not come to the point where I can believe in anything. I have to believe in something. You see the point in that? I mean, it's very true. And pantheism, my point here is that this growing pantheism, this New Age thinking, is a clear example of this statement. I cannot find the source. Man will identify. That's classic. If you think about that. It shows the credibility of biblical epistemology. That's exactly what the Bible says, not in those words. Here's the point. The Bible pictures, Romans 1 in particular, pictures unbelief as a unbelief is a philosophical matter, not a scientific matter. That is, why do men not believe? They like to say, well, I would believe, but I can't believe. But men do not believe because they can't believe. They do not believe that they will not believe. They refuse to have God. That unbelief is a matter of unbelief springs from the will. The will to believe. And of course, a lot of Christian evidence people work with the will to believe. That's a whole other area of study which we'll get into. But.
I was talking to one guy who's like 3 or 4 in discussion, and I posed a question that, okay, let's play a game, you're God, you've got something to say to me, how are you going to do it? And the Jewish guy on my left said, I'm not going to touch him. Because in a second or less, he knew exactly what was going to happen, he knew it couldn't be with you.
Yeah.
And so the light came on, but still, it had nothing to do with the ruling.
I asked a colleague at the university, when I was a fellow student, he said, asked him, do you believe in the resurrection? He said, no, by the way. I said, is it a historical doubt, unbelief, or a philosophical? Is it objective or subject? Oh, he's not there. I said, no. Are you saying that you don't believe it and would not believe under any conditions? Or that you think it might have happened, but didn't happen. And I said, under what conditions would you believe it? If Jesus might have lived there, what kind of evidence would you accept? Not for a long time. That's what I thought so. Because you understand that your unbelief has nothing to do with evidence or science. It's simply a notion. It is therefore worthless.
You are.
No, I mean, he's a friend of mine. He meant to me, this was a friend of discussion. I was trying to teach him. And he acknowledged it. You know, he hadn't thought about it. He's not thought about it that way before. But see, the point is, one of the things I want you all to see is that we as Christians have, one more statement that I'm going to credit. We have simply got to stop apologizing for our faith. As if our positions were the least likely to be true, but nevertheless is true.